So he used his imagination together with research, right, to tell that story. The main character of the book, Silvana, is based on Sukari's mother. Toward the very end of the book, Silvana, a prisoner in Bergen-Belsen camp, is raped, not by Germans, but by Dutch prisoners. In the novel, Sukari sums up her feeling of abandonment in this passage here, where she talks about how there was no one she could ask for help, not the other prisoners, not, quote, her white Jewish brothers, who treated her like an animal that had cunningly managed to invade their territory. At the very end of the book, when the camp is liberated, the liberated Jews sing Hatikva, and Silvana's character notes that, you know, quote, though she knew the words by heart, she couldn't sing with them. Only when she realized that the song was coming to an end did she join in, emphasizing her Arab accent so they would all know she too had been there.
You're listening to Doris Bergen, Anti-Semitism, Anti-Black Racism, and Misogyny. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977 or online our website, alternativeradio.org.
Another intersectional category is Black victims of Nazism, also not well integrated into studies of the field as a whole. The book by Clarence Lusane, Hitler's Black Victims, was published in 2002. Lusane, a professor at the time at Howard University, wrote a really interesting study, rarely cited or quoted by scholars in our field. Even more obscure is the book on the right, which is also fiction, written in the form of a novel by a French Martinican writer who, like Yossi Sukari, had just fragments of historical material that she wove into a novel using research and her imagination. That book tells the story based on a fragment of a diary that was found of a Martinican woman who was arrested, by Nazi Germans and kept held as a prisoner in the women's camp of Ravensbrück. In the novel, the author imagines that the character drew resilience in the Nazi camp from imagining her own enslaved ancestors. This book was given to me by a friend who is Black and Jewish. I've never seen this book mentioned in Holocaust studies. Recently in the field, there's quite a bit of interest in this man, Joseph Nassi, an American citizen born in Suriname who spent 3 years in German camps. Nassi was arrested because he was an enemy alien, so-called, his American passport. And while in those camps, he created a visual diary of about 200 images, striking images of the conditions he experienced in a series of different German camps. A really interesting study of Joseph Nassi is included in the work of Sarah Castile, Black Lives Under Nazism. I've heard Professor Castile discuss this work a number of times, and it's always been interesting to me that in a Holocaust studies audience, the thing people want to glom onto is the fact that Joseph Nassi had some Jewish ancestry. His family had not practiced Judaism for three generations, but somehow that one fact seems to make him legible to those audiences. But then what happens about the rest of his experiences? Also important, I think, as an intersectional identity is the fate of Black Germans under Nazism. Again, there are scholars, Tina Kamp, Tiffany Florville, and others who are working on this extremely interesting topic, again, which connects in multiple ways with Jewish experiences. Just to give you an example, I have a segment here from an interview conducted with two Afro-German sisters who were teenagers in Nazi Germany. Interviewed in the 1980s, they recalled some of their experiences, and Alex will read it for us.
Times were getting hard. Mother had to look for a new apartment because as a Black man, father wouldn't have gotten one. We moved into a shabby three-room flat at the edge of town, and even one of those rooms we rented out. I was signed up at a middle school where I was well-received in the beginning. Some teachers remained neutral and friendly, but others made life very hard for me from 1933 on. Often when I came home from school, my mother would notice right away that something was wrong. What's happened? And then I would cry, she would cry, we'd hold each other tight. Oh, people are so crude to do that to a 14-year-old child. I had to take part in the course on race and had to listen to statements like, God made all whites and blacks, half-breeds come from the devil, or half-breeds can only inherit the bad characteristics of both races. The teacher made me go with them to the exhibit Race and Folk. At the exhibit, they showed, among other things, retouched photos of colored people in Munich, whom I knew, with filed down teeth and weird facial expressions. They also made me go along on a trip to see a ship, even though I didn't want to. After the trolley ride, we had to march behind the flag. Of course, I walked with my head down. We had barely gotten there when the teacher called me over, stuck car fare in my hand, and said that I had to go home. As a non-Aryan, you can't march with us behind the flag.
Thank you. There's also a lot of valuable scholarship being done right now on situating the Holocaust in a global context. Really interesting work on Africans and the Holocaust, on the impact of the Holocaust on African literature, for instance. But I want to focus here on this particular manifestation of connections having to do with the film Judgment at Nuremberg. Curious how many people have seen Judgment at Nuremberg? Okay, not too small. Excellent. So, you know, the film was released in 1961, rushed to, you know, be released to coincide with the Eichmann trial. But the television debut of the movie was only in March 1965. You know, in those days, they held the movies back, right, before they put them on TV. So the film was shown in America on American TV, March 1965. But unusually, ABC interrupted the programming with breaking news from Selma, Alabama. What was that breaking news? Of course, it was police and state troopers attacking marchers for black voting rights, led by John Lewis and others. TV viewers were shocked when suddenly, instead of watching a film about the triumph of American democracy and justice, they were seeing beatings and violence. People were killed on that day, occurring in their own country. One of the strands in that film, Judgment at Nuremberg, involves the scene featuring Judy Garland. In that scene, Judy Garland plays a woman, based on a real person called Irene Zeiler, a woman who was sent to a German prison as a teenager because of involvement in a racial crime trial in 1935, Rassenschande. So the character that Garland plays, she was accused of having a sexual relationship with a German Jewish man. There was a trial in Nazi Germany. The Jewish man was executed and she was sent to prison. In the movie, post-war, an American tribunal hears the charges against the judge, right, who condemned that German Jewish man to death. The scene is incredibly intense. The German defense lawyer screams at the Judy Garland character, you know, asking her to go back in time. Did you sit on his lap? While the American judges watch on. But think about the context. In 1965, sex, marriage between black and white Americans was against the law in almost every single state. Anti-miscegenation laws in almost every single state. And across the country, intimate relations between black and white Americans were extremely dangerous and perilous. So again, thinking about how these events like collide in the viewing of that film. Another sort of embodiment of this links of black and Jewish lives and histories comes in the form of friendship. Depicted here is a very, I think, famous friendship between the Jewish theologian Abraham Joshua Heschel and Martin Luther King. Heschel marched with King at Selma and famously said, "My feet were praying." Both men recognized the profound solidarity embodied in their friendship and its significance. But there were also forces that threatened to pull them apart. In a 1958 speech to the American Jewish Congress, Martin Luther King articulated those forces, and Amy will read it.
My people were brought to America in chains. Your people were driven here to escape the chains fashioned for them in Europe. Our unity is born of our common struggle for centuries, not only to rid ourselves of bondage, but to make oppression of any people by others an impossibility. There are Hitlers loose in America today, both in high and low places. As the tensions and bewilderment of economic problems become more severe, history's scapegoats, the Jews, will be joined by new scapegoats, the Negroes. The Hitlers will seek to divert people's minds and turn their frustrations and anger to the helpless, to the outnumbered. Then whether the Negro and Jew shall live in peace will depend upon how firmly they resist, how effectively they reach the minds of the decent Americans to halt this deadly diversion.
Thank you. Thank you for that reading. These links can be really inspiring, but they're not always welcomed. When Toni Morrison dedicated her novel Beloved to the 60 million, she was criticized as a Holocaust denier or minimizer. The American literature scholar Danielle Christmas explained that Morrison did not mean to displace Jews, but rather to join them. Christmas herself has done really interesting work on, you can see the title, Auschwitz and the Plantation, how those themes are intermingled in American literature. I once saw her give a talk on this subject on Zoom during COVID, where she pointed out that the American TV series Holocaust, which came out in 1978, drew heavily on the epic, the slavery epic from the year before, Roots. When she made that observation, the chat filled up with criticisms that she was appropriating the Holocaust, distorting it, that this comment was offensive and inappropriate. However, Christmas was pointing to something really quite significant, which is that the field of Holocaust owes a huge debt to African American studies and to the civil rights movement, because it's precisely in that era that the study of the Holocaust emerged as a field in American history, and vocabulary like passing, like slave labor, even the whole way of thinking about race, these have come into the Holocaust field from African American studies, not the other way around. I want to close this section with the obvious point that connecting the Holocaust, comparing to other cases of violence, is not something new, and it has served many purposes. I won't go through those all. I would say some of those purposes I find laudable, others not. But all of them attest to the universal claim and the universal significance of the Holocaust. So let me turn to the conclusion. I hope you won't be too disappointed that I don't really have a resounding conclusion to tie everything up, but rather some important quotations, reflections, and a call to keep thinking about the links, anti-Semitism, anti-Black racism, and misogyny. So first, an important quote from Heschel, again, just reminding us of the importance of not despairing. I'm going to read it. Racism is an evil of tremendous power, but God's will transcends all powers. Surrender to despair is surrender to evil. It is important to feel anxiety. It is sinful to wallow in despair. I want to also bring a challenge from another speaker who did not survive the Holocaust, Gustava Jurecka, a Jewish writer in the Warsaw Ghetto, who used her last strength, she was murdered in Treblinka, to document the history of the destruction of her community for a future that she would not live to see. Matthew will read it for us.
The record must be hurled like a stone under history's wheel in order to stop it. One can lose all hopes except the one that the suffering and destruction of this war will make sense when they are looked at from a distant historical perspective, from suffering unparalleled in history, from bloody tears and bloody sweat. A chronicle of days of hell is being composed, which will help explain the historical reasons for why people came to think as they did, and why regimes arose that caused such suffering.
Thank you. This is a real challenge to thinking about the power of history, right? Another, I think, challenge closer to home in time and place comes from James Baldwin, his 1985 book, The Evidence of Things Not Seen. Baldwin's analysis here, I think, is as incisive and relevant now as it was 40 years ago, calling us to find the courage to look and see what is going on, and Maureen will read it.
The cowardice of this time and place, this era, is nowhere more clearly revealed than in the perpetual attempt to make the public and social disaster the result or the issue of a single demented creature, or perhaps half a dozen such creatures, who have quite incomprehensibly gone off their rockers and who must be murdered or locked up. Thus, for example, these present days, to describe a person or group of persons as leftists, guerrillas, or terrorists, is to dismiss their claims to human attention. We are not compelled to think of them at all anymore, except as the vermin that must be destroyed. Or, in another way, but for the same reason, we are still attempting to explain Hitler away. We do not wish to see him in our mirror.
For me, one of the concepts that has been helpful to think about recognizing these links is the concept of a conversation where equal autonomous partners both listen and speak, that importance of listening. And another important concept is the concept of commonalities. Nate Leipziger, Polish-Jewish survivor who lives in Toronto, gave me, in his terms, this concept, commonalities, to describe how he came to work and present together with a number of survivors of Indigenous residential schools in Canada. For Leipziger and Eugene Arcand and other conversation partners, they did not equate their experiences, but they focused on their common trauma and common loss. One of those common traumas was sexual abuse, which Leipziger, Arcand, and many other survivors of residential schools endured, both boys and girls. And for Nate Leipziger, the Holocaust survivor, talking and sharing that common experience of sexual abuse was incredibly emboldening. He never talked about it until his friendship with Ted Fontaine and Eugene Arcand. Thinking about commonalities made me sort of think about the commonalities that go below the surface, including the commonalities, you could say, of the grave, of bodies. A few years ago in Saskatchewan, where I come from in Western Canada, excavation of unmarked graves around a residential school site found human remains, a fragment of a jawbone of a child. You can see here that press release where the First Nations talk about that finding. I couldn't stop thinking about the words of a writer from the Holocaust period over the graves of murdered children, poisoned flowers grow. And to think about how the legacies of loss, the resilience that somehow is fought despite that legacy of loss is shared across every case of human suffering and violence. From solidarity, from commonalities, it's a small step to solidarity. And here I want to draw attention to a poem, 2014 poem by the Palestinian poet Nawwan Darwish, called Who Remembers the Armenians. Darwish took that title from Hitler's taunt in 1939 when Germany was about to invade Poland. Who remembers the Armenians? Like, we will have impunity like that. And to hear this poem, we have Aaron.
Who remembers the Armenians? I remember them, and I ride the nightmare bus with them. Each night, and my coffee this morning, I'm drinking it with them. You murderer, who remembers you?
Thank you. I want to end with one last quotation. This one not from someone famous or from a poet, not so eloquent, but rather from a woman who survived the Holocaust. She's from Bulgaria and reflects on what it might mean. With hesitancy, with self-consciousness, with uncertainty, but also with humanity. And Aaron will read this one for us as well.
I always wonder what it have been with me as a person, as a human being, if I didn't have a little bit of suffering in my life. Thank God we weren't killed and all that, but this helped me so much to become a human being. I know that today I cannot say about the blacks or to say the yellows. I cannot say anything because I know how deprived I felt when they, those in power, were against me. So this maybe helped a little bit. I don't know. Maybe it's a crazy thing to say.
And that's the note I want to end on. This maybe helped a little bit. I don't know. Maybe it's a crazy thing to say. Thank you for your attention.
I honestly didn't grow up learning that much about the Holocaust. It's not something I'm proud of at all. It just didn't come from a great town. But wasn't Hitler's whole thing creating some sort of like superior race? And wouldn't that kind of be relevant to what you're speaking about?
I think this is like a simple way, people like, you know, the perfect race or whatever. There's more confusion around that idea. Much more, I guess, important is to think about that idea of dominance, because you could see like that propaganda of the perfect race and so on. But if you actually look at how Nazi programs of killing operated, you could see, you know, at the center, Jews being targeted, not because they were deemed imperfect or inferior, but because they were deemed to be supposedly the enemies of the Aryan race. And you also see that the first victims of mass killing were people with disabilities. And often people say, well, that was about making the perfect race. But again, scholars have really been working on this. Only certain kinds of people with disabilities were killed. So for example, often people who were deemed useful for labor were allowed to stay alive. People who were deemed useless eaters were killed. So in addition to that idea of the so-called superior race, it's really about domination. What's the hallmark of a superior race? Hitler was a social Darwinist. If you're not expanding in a social Darwinism view, you're being pushed back, right? And what allows expansion? Two things, soldiers and babies, which they kind of boil down to the same. So that idea of the superior race is less, I think what's often imagined is they wanted everyone to be blonde and blue-eyed. You know, there's all those jokes, right? What does the perfect Aryan look like? Slim like Goering, you know, who was a fat guy, handsome like Himmler, very homely, blonde like Hitler. Like, they even realize it doesn't make any sense. But the big thing is about power, domination, expansion. So almost the ideology of we're creating this perfect future is just like almost one of the tools in the package of, yeah, expansion, domination, a military state that is going to be, you know, controlling its neighbors, absorbing those deemed valuable, and eradicating those deemed worthless. So yeah, thanks for that.
Doris, can you chat about how your Mennonite background in Saskatchewan ties into your work?
You know, questions like that, they always make me a bit uncomfortable, because I feel like being a scholar, it's not just about, I study this because that's who I am. I never was interested in Canadian history. Is that bad to say? I don't feel like because I'm Canadian, I had to study Canadian history. And yet it is an interesting question. So my background is Mennonite. It's not so much the religious background, but my parents were born in Soviet Union, Soviet Ukraine in the 1920s. They came to Canada as children. And I never wanted to study like my own family history or things like that. But you bring certain tools that almost allow you to do certain things because of your background. I spent 11 years in various Christian schools. And because of that, I learned a lot about like the Bible and stuff. So I could study military chaplains in a certain way because I understood certain things. And that's definitely linked to my background. Same with some aspects of the Holocaust. I didn't learn German at home from my parents, but my grandparents spoke like German, Russian, Ukrainian. I heard those made it easier for me to learn that. So I think it's not like a straight on thing. I feel like, you know, oh, I'm a white person, so I have to study white people, or I'm a woman, so I have to study women. I feel like the great thing about scholarship is you can develop the tools to pursue the things that interest you, and the connections might not always be obvious. Nevertheless, I would say who you are doesn't shape, you know, what you do as a scholar directly, but it shapes kind of what you think about, what seems important to you. You know what I mean? What strikes you as significant or interesting? So that's what I would say. And then more specific, if anyone is interested in Mennonite history, there is a project I did together with Mark Jansen and a guy called John Thiessen called European Mennonites and the Holocaust. And it's actually really important thinking about the role of Mennonites, including as killers, which is kind of shocking to people who think Mennonites are pacifist. Thanks.
Do you have any idea about how to counter racism, misogyny, and anti-Semitism and scapegoating? And then she adds this caveat, reflecting the time kind of we live in, of the current administration. And then the comment is immediately challenged, again, reflecting the time we live in, by somebody who says, like, what are you talking about anti-Semitism of the current administration? They're certainly not anti-Semitic. So again, but the main point, of course, is like countering these things you're just so very eloquently analyzed.
If I had a really good answer to that question, you know, would I be like a professor, you know, at a university, whatever? I mean, this is the crucial question. And it seems to me it's the question that goes right back to us, right? It's like, how do you counter things? You try to recognize them. You try to see them. You try to listen to the people on the receiving end, right, of those threats and violence. And I think, you know, you try to find solidarity with others rather than thinking, oh, I'm only concerned about my own people or my own family or my own group. You try to find some solidarity. I feel like that is a really crucial point, some strength in numbers. But yeah, I think this is like the challenge for each of us, right? Looking out, like, what is the world around us right now? And how do we find the people we trust and our friends? Even if you do like something as basic as like helping one person, it could be a really concrete thing. So that's what I think. You got to find your allies and friends. Thanks to all of you for being here. Thank you.
You were just listening to Doris Bergen, Anti-Semitism, Anti-Black Racism, and Misogyny. She spoke at the University of Colorado at Boulder in February. Doris Bergen is Professor of Holocaust Studies at the University of Toronto. This program is produced by Alternative Radio. We're an independent nonprofit in our 39th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Gabor Mate, Shama Sawant, Chris Hedges, Tariq Ali, Norman Finkelstein, and Francesca Albanese. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Doris Bergen, Anti-Semitism, Anti-Black Racism, and Misogyny, and for Howard Zinn's classic book, You Can't Be Neutral on a Moving Train, call us 1-800-444-1977 or online our website, alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us 1-800-444-1977. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening. We go out with Daniel Barenboim, performing Beethoven's Waldstein Sonata.
Your mother, your sister, your girlfriend, One in six women is a victim of sexual assault. Now think about your father, your brother, your best friend. Men are victims too. Rape can happen to anyone. This is Christina Ricci with RAIN, encouraging you to call the National Sexual Assault Hotline to learn how to support someone you love. Call 1-800-656-HOPE or visit RAIN.org. That's RAINN.org.
Brought to you by RAIN and this station.
Nuclear Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Now and forever.
The lessons here is that defeating the kind of fascism we face now requires something deeper than defeating the current administration or winning elections. But it requires a deeper ideological shift. That means thinking beyond nation and pledging allegiance, not to Israel, not to the United States, but to the world and all life, all living things. It means standing up for the oppressed everywhere, right? That's what solidarity means.
That's Robin R.D. Kelly, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Robin D.G. Kelly, Solidarity and Black Resistance to Fascism and Genocide. Langston Hughes, the great African-American poet, said decades ago, "Fascism is a new name for the kind of terror the Negro has always faced in America. Fascism can and has led to genocide." Progressive African-American intellectuals, writers, poets, musicians have had a long tradition and history of solidarity and resisting fascism and genocide. From Frederick Douglass to Gil Scott-Heron, from Sojourner Truth to Angela Davis, from W.E.B. Du Bois to John Lewis, from Paul Robeson to Amiri Baraka, from Ida B. Wells to Malcolm X, from Ella Baker to Dr. King, from Harry Belafonte to Sonny Rollins, from James Baldwin to Cornel West, and up to the present moment where Robin D.G. Kelly warns we're witnessing the consolidation of a fascist police state. Our guest today is Robin D.G. Kelly. He's professor of history at UCLA, a distinguished scholar, public intellectual, and award-winning author. Among his many books are Race Rebels, Thelonious Monk, and Freedom Dreams. He spoke at UMass Amherst in April 2025. And now, Robin D.G. Kelly.
So I want to begin with where we are now. Let me start with the recent story about someone MAGA leaders call an American hero, a patriot. So on May Day 2023, the ex-Marine Daniel Penny choked to death an unarmed, unhoused black man named Jordan Neely on a Manhattan subway train. Now, Neely was deemed a threat because he shouted, "I want food, I'm not taking no for an answer, I don't mind going to jail and getting life in prison, I'm ready to die." Now, you all know the story, I'm not going to repeat that. Penny was arrested 11 days later, but only after public pressure forced the police to arrest him. Wealthy Republicans gave generously to his defense fund. He raised like $2.8 million in 6 weeks. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, which is like the second most embarrassing graduate of Yale University, you called him a good Samaritan. And you're like, who's first? J.D. Vance, right? So he called Penny a good Samaritan, which, you know, is a bizarre association when you think about it, given the fact that he's Catholic and clearly hadn't read the Bible, because Jesus' parable of the Good Samaritan, he stops and helps a man who had been badly beaten and robbed, bandaging his wounds, housing and caring for him when others pass him by, you know? So Daniel Penny killed the suffering man in need, and for this he was rewarded. He walked out of the courtroom on December 9th, 2024, a free man, richer than he had ever been, and a darling of the MAGA movement. 5 days later, Trump invites Penny to watch the annual Army-Navy football game in his luxury box. And who is he joined by? Elon Musk, Ron DeSantis, and J.D. Vance, who wrote on social media, it was a scandal Penny was ever prosecuted in the first place. Now, of course, this is a repeat of Kyle Rittenhouse, who received, you know, the same kind of treatment for killing two unarmed Black Lives Matter protesters in Wisconsin in 2020. The right poured $2 million into his war chest. Trump praised him and invited him to the White House. And in fact, it came out later, Trump ordered federal law enforcement to say positive things about Rittenhouse to the press. And Bill Ackman, which is the man who's trying to make Harvard white again, called Rittenhouse a patriot. Now, in February of this year, Andreessen Horowitz, a leading Silicon Valley venture capital firm, hired Daniel Penny, having no prior experience in finance. In fact, Mark Andreessen, co-founder of the firm, he had given the Trump campaign like $3 million, both in a super PAC and directly to his campaign. And he also continues to provide vital support for Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency. Now, tall, fit, blonde-haired, chiseled figures, features, he's an Aryan ideal. Daniel Penny was the perfect symbol for America's fascist turn under Trump and Project 2025's plan to dismantle much of the administrative state, curtail civil liberties, concentrate power in the executive branch, and redistribute wealth upwards. Now, Penny embodied the kind of pared-down muscular state, right? Operating alone, above the law, willing to do what it takes to annihilate the threat. And that threat, of course, is an unhoused, disabled, so-called violent Black man. Jordan Neely represented all that was wrong with America. Dependency, entitlements, Black criminality, liberal constraints on law enforcement, DEIA, even the existence of public transportation. Penny represented the will and the vision of the Heritage Foundation and the cabal of unelected billionaires committed to eliminating the social safety net, workers' bargaining rights, affordable health care, public health safeguards, enforcement of civil and disability rights, academic freedom, investment in renewable energy, regulations on pollution and fossil fuel extraction, as well as criminalizing anti-racism, anti-sexism, and trans identity. Rising white nationalism, racist violence, xenophobia, and the economic deterioration of the working class prepared the way for Trump's second term and the imminent reality we're facing right now. Project 2025 and the alt-right, their roots go back to Charles Koch. If you look at, you know, the origins of the Institute for Humane Studies in 1961, for example, or Murray Rothbard, or Charles Murray and Richard Herrnstein, who were the authors of The Bell Curve, that claimed race explained IQ differences. Now, these cats believe in eugenics. Okay, this is very important. They believed in human diversity, right? But human diversity as fixed, immutable, and hierarchical. They insisted that some groups or stocks, right, were not suitable for freedom or self-rule precisely because of their genetic makeup. So consider at least three people who actually contributed to Project 2025. Dr. Jason Richwine, doctor, remember, got a PhD, doesn't make you smart. he argued that Latinx people had lower IQs than white people and proposed using IQ tests to determine immigrant entry into the United States. And he was just appointed to a very high-ranking position at the National Institute of Standards and Technology. Corey Stewart, a failed GOP Senate candidate from Virginia, defender of the Confederacy and the Confederate flag, he had direct ties to Jason Kessler, who organized the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville in 2017. Now, Richard Hanania, I don't know why I can't say this, because he disturbs me so much. Hanania, who promoted eugenics and forced sterilization of low IQ people, which he suggested were mostly black people. Actually, I know why I can't say his name, and I'll say in a second. He wrote for alt-right white nationalist publications under pseudonym, and he published this terrible book called The Origins of Woke. He also earned a PhD from UCLA in 2018, and I used to see him, you know, in political science. No disrespect for the discipline, but, you know, in 2010, he wrote, "If the races are equal, why do whites always end up near the top and blacks at the bottom, everywhere and always?" He wrote, "For the white gene pool to be created, millions had to die. Race mixing is like destroying a unique species of or piece of art. It's shameful." Hanania also wrote a recent statement on social media. He said, "Don't Daniel Penny get in charge. These people are animals, whether they're harassing people in subways or walking around in suits." It's ironic because Hanania would not be considered white by MAGA standards because he's Palestinian Christian of Jordanian descent. Okay, so one of the points I want to make here is that when Trump issues an executive order ending illegal discrimination and restoring merit-based opportunity and accuses DEIA of violating federal civil rights laws and undermining American values of hard work, excellence, and individual achievement in favor of unlawful, corrosive, these are his words, or actually the statement's words, corrosive and pernicious identity-based spoiled systems, we know it is a lie because they don't believe it. And if you need proof that they believe in a merit-based opportunity system, all you have to do is look at Trump's cabinet picks, right? They don't believe in merit-based. Think about that. Or look at Daniel Penny's job offer. You know, no skills, and yet he's got this gig. Besides, if the Trump Project 2025 people really believed that white men are real victims of racism, then they would not dismantle the laws, institutions, and agencies designed to address discrimination. In fact, what they would do is they would repurpose those institutions that are designed to address discrimination for the purposes of protecting white people. But what they're doing instead is claiming the right to be racist and to use the levers of the state to reinstitute a form of apartheid or Jim Crow. And instead, they turn to fiction. And, you know, the amount of fiction that comes out of these executive orders and comes out of the mouths of all these people, it's astounding to me, you know. But Trump's most recent executive order claims the Smithsonian Institution is, quote, under the influence of a divisive, race-centered ideology that promotes, quote, narratives that portray American and Western values as inherently harmful and oppressive. Of course, no one teaches that. Restoring truth and sanity, according to the order, means accepting race as a biological reality. Now, I want you to follow me here. He's arguing, or I shouldn't say he, the people behind Trump, the whole Project 2025 people, the people who go back to the bell curve, are actually arguing that race is a biological reality and not a social construct. The very idea that race is a human invention, according to Trump, is a dangerous lie. And of course, that makes perfect sense given the logic, because if you believe that diversity or difference is immutable, and that there's a kind of a hierarchy, then you have to believe that race is biological. You can't believe it's socially constructed. Now, promoting ableism is a central part of their plans. And as we know, it's foundational to fascism. It's as important as race, right? Ableism. The able body is a metaphor for the nation. They're obsessed with masculine energy, with trad wives. They continue to defund medical research, dismantling the EPA, shielding corporations from liability, from anything, for pollution, manufacturing chemicals like herbicides, like Roundup, workplace injury, firearms manufacturing, and just deregulating all that. And all of these assaults are on people with disabilities. And of course, don't be surprised when they start proposing, you know, forced sterilization, which is a universal fascist policy. Now, Trump's anti-trans orders harken back to the Lavender Scare of the 1940s and 50s, which intertwine homophobia and anti-communism and resulted in a kind of, in the purging of at least some 5,000 queer people from federal government jobs. And in fact, if you count the numbers, way more people were fired as a result of being gay or lesbian or being accused of being gay or lesbian, whatever, than communists. You know, the Lavender Scare was way more devastating in terms of people's lives. Nevertheless, you know, and this is in some ways the Trump era is a combination of those things. Trump issued at least 6 anti-trans executive orders, banning what it calls harmful gender ideology, declaring there are only 2 sexes, collapsing gender identity under the category of sex, requiring that all official documents, such as visas and passports, use only the sex assigned at birth, barring trans people from sports and the military, punishing schools for supporting trans students, prohibiting federal funding for gender-affirming care for anyone under 19, or any medical schools, for that matter, or hospitals that research transgender health. So if you take all this stuff together, these bans essentially facilitate the destruction of trans people as an identity group, stripping them of any federal recognition or any legal protections. And you know what that's called? It's called genocide. That is the definition. The Lemkin Institute for Genocide Prevention and Human Security has already warned that Trump's executive orders and the policies that follow, quote, are in line with a genocidal process against the transgender community. And the last one I want to talk about is this police state we're living under. One of the functions of the state that DOGE has not slashed is the coercive arm. Law enforcement, you know, with the exception of the FBI, and that's a very specific thing, and military continue to enjoy strong financial support, but the administration has practically eliminated any sort of accountability or police misconduct. So on his first day in office, the same Trump granted clemency, the same day that he granted clemency to nearly 1,600 felons convicted of crimes associated with the January 6th insurrection, he rescinded Biden-era police and criminal justice reforms, he restored the federal death penalty, made the killing of a police officer a federal capital crime, and directed the Attorney General and the Secretary of Homeland Security to establish Homeland Security task forces to be made up of federal, state, and local police officers. Under the guise of fighting violent crimes, it serves as a deportation force. It raids workplaces, apartment complexes, neighborhoods, and universities where it has abducted and jailed foreign national students just for protesting the genocide in Gaza. So by executive order, Trump also created the DC Safe and Beautiful Task Force. Think about that. DC for District of Columbia. Headed by who? The racist Stephen Miller. And the task force will coordinate local officials to deport so-called illegals, increase the overall police presence, and speed up the processing of applications to carry concealed weapons. You think about what that means, right? So we're witnessing the consolidation of a fascist police state, although, and then this is one of the points I want to make right now, is that for some of us, this has been a permanent feature of life. So Langston Hughes, who in a speech in 1936 said, "Fascism is a new name for that kind of terror the Negro has always faced in America. You know, this kind of terrorism is extending more and more to groups of peoples whose skins are not black." Now, Hughes, of course, was not alone in understanding fascism in this way. Black radical intellectuals, you know, had located the roots of European fascism in the colonial order long before Hannah Arendt or Jean-Paul Sartre, and others had made the same argument. And, you know, after World War II, the publication of Aimé Césaire's Discourse on Colonialism, where he argued that the real crime of fascism was the application of colonial procedures to Europeans, which, quote, until then had been reserved for the Arabs of Algeria, the Coolies of India, and the blacks of Africa. And he observes that Europeans tolerated Nazism, this is a quote, before it was inflicted on them, that they absolved it, shut their eyes to it, legitimized it, because until then, it had been applied only to non-European peoples. Think of it, he continues. 90,000 dead in Madagascar, Indochina trampled underfoot, crushed to bits, assassinated, torturers brought back from the depth of the Middle Ages. And my favorite quote from Du Bois from The World in Africa, where he writes, "There was no Nazi atrocity which Christian civilization or Europe had not long been practicing against colored folk in all parts of the world in the name of and for the defense of a superior race born to rule the world." In other words, fascism was not some aberration from the march of progress. It was the logical development of Western civilization itself, a civilization based on racial classification and hierarchy, on colonial domination, capitalist exploitation, and violence, the violence that comes with it, dispossession, enclosure, slavery, state regulation, and state regulation and reproduction. So settler colonialism is an expression of this incipient fascism. That's what we're talking about, the long durée. The fascist state never portrayed itself as against the people. It claims to be an expression of the people partly to protect us from those who are not the people. You know, so in other words, the people are those who are outside the people. Those are the others. Black people, immigrants, Jews, Roma. And we can call this anti-democratic democracy. It's always grounded in the production of racial difference and is foundational to settler colonialism. Therefore, from this perspective, fascism is not at odds with liberal democracy. In fact, Michael Hanchard shows in his book, The Spectre of Race, every modern democracy was founded as an ethno-national racial state, every single one. Think about it. Every modern democracy was founded as an ethno-national racial state. That means the exclusion, subjugation, and persecution of some other are not the people, right? So we're talking about democracy for the people. It's not always for all the people. The rise of fascism and the global economic crisis was the context for the radical turn in black scholarship. And, you know, you've got W. Du Bois writes the Black Reconstruction in 1935. C.L.R. James writes History of Negro Revolt, the Black Jacobins in 1938. You have the writings of Louise Thompson Patterson, George Padmore, Claudia Jones, Marvell Cook, Ella Baker, Richard Wright, and so forth. They were all produced in response to fascism and the growing anti-colonial movement. And as Cedric Robinson argued decades ago, the confrontation with fascism led these same intellectuals to, you know, study and examine black revolt through a kind of limited Marxist lens, forcing the best of those to adjust that lens, right, and therefore contribute to a new understanding of expressions of black resistance. The black left saw fascism on the horizon because it was familiar to them. They knew it. They recognized it. They were what they used to call premature anti-fascists. So when the American ruling class was celebrating Mussolini for crushing communists and labor and bringing about stability in Italy, right, African Americans and the black, the diaspora as a whole, was resisting that. In fact, we can go to the next slide, I think. The mainstream press, right, this is the U.S. press and the Western press generally, They love Mussolini. They loved him. They ran admiring and fawning articles on Mussolini, and the success of Italian fascism throughout the decade, even into the mid-1930s. So we're talking about Fortune magazine, Time magazine, owned by Henry Luce, Business Weekly, Survey Graphic, Barron's, The New Republic, and the Saturday Evening Post ran a bunch of articles. In December 1927, issue of Nation's Business, which was the official organ of the Chamber of Commerce, its editor, Merle Thorpe, published an editorial titled That Man Mussolini. And he wrote, and you know, he's in love with Mussolini. He says, I can understand why a businessman would admire Mussolini and his methods. They are essentially those of successful business, executive action, deeds, not words. The impression you get of Mussolini is that he is a fine type of business executive. He cuts through, not fine-spoken theories, not plans, not speeches he's going to make, none of these. Things done, and that is your successful American executive. The president of the New York Stock Exchange, E.H.H. Simmons, praised Mussolini for defeating communism, which he called, quote, that evil disease from the Orient. And that's something to remember. J.P. Morgan loaned Italy like $100 million in 1926. So fascism, to sum up this part, or what Mussolini called corporatism, proved to a certain extent to be capitalism's savior. So what are the characteristics of fascism? Abandoning democracy and civil liberties under the guise of the state of emergency. An authoritarian state built on an ideology of racial destiny, which justifies internal violence, that is, ethnic cleansing, racial cleansing, and external expansion. And note that all fascist and authoritarian states pursued some level of imperialist ventures, every single one. Brutally suppressing strikes and outlawing labor unions is another kind of element or component of fascism. In other words, making workers dependent on a coercive state. But let me just say a couple words about Italy to illustrate my point about the colonial roots of fascism. So bear with me. So like a lot of Europe, basically almost all of Europe after World War I, Italy, you know, ended the war in debt, high unemployment. You have strike waves everywhere, especially in Turin. Working class insurrections, often led by socialists, communists, and anarchists. The Liberal Party was in power in Italy, but lost control of the economy and the country. Mussolini, who was a former socialist, got to remember that, who left his party because of his opposition to nationalism. And just a side note, the most amazing thing about the Italian Communist Party and Italian socialists is that they held on to internationalism. They resisted the war. Whereas a lot of the other socialists in the Second International, they became nationalists right away. So Mussolini's pissed off about that, so he formed the Black Shirts, these paramilitary squads made up of disgruntled veterans. They attacked socialists and communists. The Liberal Party had a choice. Now, they could have collaborated with the Communist Party or the fascists, and they chose the fascists. Liberals make bad choices. I'm just saying. So trade unions called a general strike in 1922. The fascists crushed the strike, marched on Rome, and basically seized power because they were not interested in collaboration with the Liberal Party. The Liberal Party just capitulated, saying, well, here, you got power. So Mussolini's now in power. He's set to rebuild the Roman Empire to restore national pride. So what does he do? Well, he already has Libya, so he invades Ethiopia. Now, we have to pay attention to the brutality of Italian colonialism because one of the big myths about Italian fascism is that it was more benign and not as racist as, say, the Nazis. The fascists did come to see themselves as a race, right? A Mediterranean version of Aryans. And while they did not organize Jewish death camps to that degree, they practiced fascist violence in the colonies. But even before the fascists, and this is the most important thing I really want you to take away with this, before the fascists came to power, right, Italy, like all imperial countries, wage a brutal genocidal war in the colonies. So during the Italo-Turkish War in 1911, Italy colonized Libya, which had been a part of the Ottoman Empire. Under the Liberal Party, so it's under the Liberal Party that Italy's occupying forces gassed and starved Libyans, created concentration camps, ultimately killed one-tenth of the population. In 1935, jump forward, the Italian military used mustard gas on Ethiopians in violation of Geneva protocols of 1925, which banned its use, killed a 250,000 Ethiopians within 3 years of the war, and by some estimates, one-third died from chemical weapons. And this may sound familiar, they bombed Red Cross hospitals and ambulances. They massacred prisoners. Italy's occupation of Ethiopia lasted until 1943, and Italy did not formally recognize Ethiopia's sovereignty until 1947. But the biggest issue to me is that the Western countries were very quick to recognize Italy's occupation of Ethiopia as legitimate, and war crimes were ignored until 1940, when other Western powers entered, you know, the war against Italy. They still didn't really address war crimes. Soviets initially said nothing before the League of Nations, in part because they were selling coal and oil to Italy. So technically, and this is an argument that I make all the time and have been making it for 30 years, World War II begins on African soil.
You're listening to Robin...
WRCT Pittsburgh.